He got something to say.
All right, live and direct from the 202. It's your boy Joel for another episode of the Global Citizen Podcast. Shout out to everybody keeping safe, doing their best to keep safe. It's been a week since I last published something, and the world is still kind of crazy. So everybody hang tight. Today, I am really excited for my guest. I met my guest, I want to say, in like 2011. We'll get to that in a second. But my guest is Fritz Charles, who's a native of Queens, New York. Shout out to the 718. I hope he still has a 718 number. I hope so.
646. So same family.
It passes. Yeah, same family. Exactly. Fritz is a technologist who began his career in finance. After starting his career on Wall Street, Fritz transitioned to the technology space, focusing on mobile applications and blockchain. He has spent time working at the NBA, IAC, and at numerous tech startups in space. On the side, Fritz works on projects that increase the technology and industry's growth in his parents' homeland of Haiti, and Africa, as well as increasing racial equity in the tech space in the U.S. Fritz, welcome to the Global Citizen Podcast, man.
Joel, thank you. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here. Like you said, it's been a long minute, but I've been following your work digitally, and
likewise,
it's always inspiring to hear about, to see, you know, what part of the world you're in, what impact you're doing, and the continued good work that you're making happen. So, thank you for bringing me on.
Yeah, man. Thank you. Same for you, man. I've been definitely, you know, watching you from afar, not only professionally, but personally. You know, with social media, you see everyone's life. So I see that
Right. Your
family, you've expanded your family, beautiful family.
Thank you.
So we met. So I feel like we met at a conference in Miami.
Yes. This is way back. This is
way back.
This is, I think you were working in Haiti at the time, exactly. our parents' native land. At the time, it was probably, I don't know if it was a full year, but relatively close to the earthquake time. And there was a conference in Haiti that was focused on, I guess, the build back. And exactly. You know, you were on the ground, you know, doing some stuff. I was in business school at the time, so I attended Wharton. Got my MBA at Wharton, and you know, obviously it's a business school, but after the you know, there's actually, you know, there's a social impact lean that people aspire to. Obviously, you know, we you could question whether it actually happens amongst the Wharton folks, but they aspire to, you know, kind of combine business with social good. And because the earthquake happened while I was in school, you know, I was able to kind of rally with some classmates to kind of help put something together where we were consulting with some of the organizations on the ground, helping them with how to source materials, how to organize volunteers, et cetera. So, quote unquote, trying to use our business skills to help the nonprofits on the ground. And like that kind of pushed me to kind of be passionate around how trying to help and play a part. And so that's kind of what led me to go to that conference and, you know, met you and heard about the awesome work you were doing at the time on the ground.
Yeah. It was definitely in Miami. And I remember you definitely were in grad school. It was a good space, such a long time ago. It's crazy.
I mean, it's actually a little, I mean, this podcast is not for that. It's a little sad to think about it because I think at the time I was very optimistic about Haiti's rebirth. And now, I mean, we are years since then, and the progress has been fleeting, to say the least. You know, this is before COVID, just general. Haiti has not progressed to the point. And a short anecdote before I, you know, not to push us on this whole Haiti tangent, but, you know, you said I expanded my family and, you know, I've been blessed to, you know, be married. I have a daughter, but I actually got married in Haiti. You know, so like I always so I went and, you know, had a wedding in a town called Pétionville, which is a nice area outside of Port-au-Prince, but more, you know, 90% of my wedding party of about 150. Well, actually 99% of the participants did not live in Haiti. So was able to fly in, and you know, I always like to say I increased the Haiti GDP in you one sure weekend.
Boy, people are staying at Kinam,
exactly. Wow. So I wanted to kind of see the I wanted to use that as use my wedding as an example to like bring people to the island, and hopefully maybe some of them would develop a love for it and consider it on their vacation list, you know, alongside Barbados and Jamaica, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But like, yeah, I love to see the lead. Anyway, that's a whole tangent. We should probably have a whole nother podcast about Haiti.
Yeah.
Its progress, the lack thereof.
Absolutely. And real quick to add to that, you know, at some point soon, Haiti's probably the only place they'll be accepting Americans to come through, because it's just not looking good. Correct me if I'm mistaken, your wife is from Kenya, because I remember you went and either I was living there or I had just left, and I was really
she's from Nairobi, exactly. Yeah, you spent time there. I think I was going there to visit. I don't know if I was married at the time, so maybe my future in-laws or my in-laws. I wanted to reconnect, man, hear how it was for you living out there. Yeah. And seeing,
have the time to do that. And I'm sure you went out there and got that dowry ready.
Of course.
A lot. Those guys joke about that a lot. But we definitely will reconnect on that. There's so much to catch up on. For me, with some of the ways, and I know some of my friends as well, we've been using our time during the Rona is to kind of touch up or educate ourselves on all things finance. I think a lot of us are thinking about the future. When you're by yourself, you can think about a lot of things. So for some of my listeners who might not be up to par on all the lingo, can you explain what blockchain is?
Sure. So blockchain is obviously something that people have heard the term. It's questionable, how many people know exactly how it works. But basically, it's the technology that is behind Bitcoin and the other cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin is obviously the technology that is almost like an internet money. I like to call it like Venmo, Cash App, PayPal, but without those companies in between. And the reason why you don't need those companies in between is because of the blockchain. And the blockchain is basically a technology. If you think about a bank is basically a ledger, or almost like a spreadsheet that keeps an account of how much money, you paid a bill of $100. They know to debit your account, like remove $100 from your account and increase the account of the, electricity company $100. So that's what a bank does. Blockchain does the same exact thing, but without people being involved. It's all technology based. And it's basically, I like to call it almost like a Google spreadsheet that everybody has access to. Versus a bank being an Excel sheet. So Excel sheet, you put some numbers in or whatever it is, you have it on your computer. It's hard for somebody else to access that. Therefore, it's easy for you to doctor it. Now, on a Google spreadsheet, that it's hard to be doctored if a lot of people can see what you do, see what the history is. And so blockchain is basically a centralized database or ledger, but to put them simply a place where there's information that everybody could access. People could change, but it only could be changed if the wider community says it's okay to be changed. And then that's what makes it solid. So it replaces a central party, but what makes it trustworthy is it being decentralized. And because everybody could see it, everybody could check on the validity on any new information gets added or removed, and then they kind of could be built and brought that way. It's probably a technology that necessitates a longer discussion, but I would just say think of it as a Google spreadsheet where a lot of people could access it, a lot of people could edit it, but if somebody edits something and puts something that's wrong, there's going to be a lot of other people that could check them. And that's what it allows it to do. And so it, and if you think about it, that's what a bank allows, because you could trust that bank. You trust that they are not going to allow you to, or you're somebody else, to doctor how much money is there in your account. And because they have a big brand, you know, you trust the numbers that they tell you reflect the money you have. Blockchain does the same thing, but it does it from the community being the fact checkers, if you will.
Gotcha. I mean, I know blockchain's always, I don't say always, but I would say maybe 2 years to 18 months ago, it was really picking up in terms of popularity, and people were really informing themselves. People who weren't in the know weren't informing themselves a lot. I know a lot of folks in Kenya were very much interested investing in some Bitcoin. Do you feel like that wave has continued, or do you think it has lost a little bit of its popularity?
You know, I mean, I think obviously it lost steam after 2017 to 2018. That fourth quarter of 2017, like that, especially that Thanksgiving, the Christmas period, like I feel like over half the people in this world, or at least in this country, were Bitcoin was probably one of the topics that came up during the Thanksgiving dinner. It was super popular, super hot. A lot of people didn't know what was going on. And, you know, it was more so, it was definitely like felt like a get rich marathon, or not even a sprint. So obviously, and you know, that's what happens. I mean, obviously people want to, you know, improve their stock. And so if they hear about something to make money from, that's kind of what happens. And at that time, what happens is, and not to go too deep, but basically big blockchain, obviously everybody can see Bitcoin, which is basically internet money that's based on code. You could see the code, right? So you could like basically think of like a restaurant having its recipe out on the internet. And so you could have other restaurants kind of just copy the same recipe and make their own dishes. What happened at that time, a lot of people were looking at the Bitcoin technology and they were making their own. And so that's how you get a lot of the other ones that people might have heard of, like Ripple and Ethereum and stuff like that. So that was also what was pushing it. So you just had like, you went from like maybe five cryptocurrencies to over 1,000, because everybody was able to say, hey, I'm going to create the Bitcoin for remittances. I'm going to create Bitcoin for law. I'm going to create Bitcoin for fantasy sports. And people felt like they had the ability to invest in companies at their infancy. And unfortunately, a lot of those projects did not come to fruition. And that's kind of what put a damper on the space. I would say that's the main reason. That being said, Bitcoin obviously still is around. There's a lot of strong projects that have stabilized. So the majority of the projects did not do anything, but there's a minority that are strong that are continuing to build. And there's a lot of interesting things going on. You even have like large companies like, you know, Oracle and Facebook and JP Morgan looking at blockchain related projects. So the space is definitely something to pay attention to. Is it something to invest in? I think it is, but it should be a very small percentage of your portfolio. Like money you could lose. Like this is think of it as now you're in Corona. You had an X amount of money that you used to spend on going out and partying and having drinks. Maybe you allocate that money a little bit to crypto, but not your retirement, not your savings, not your rent money. It would not be responsible to do so. So that's kind of where how I advise folks.
Right. I'll definitely think about that advice, because I feel like my drink money is going to sneakers, but that's another topic for another day. But yeah, thanks for that description. With that said, I just kind of looking at your profile a little bit more. Can you give a few examples of the projects you work on in Haiti and in Africa, and where in Africa?
Sure. So I'll start with Africa. So my tech career actually started working at an African tech startup So, you know, we mentioned I went to grad school. My first school was in finance. I worked at the historic Lehman Brothers. We could kind of get into that when we talk more about bond stuff. But went to Wharton and kind of, you know, fell in love with tech and startups. And particularly, you spent time in Kenya, but I actually did a thesis around M-Pesa, how people were using money, their phone to send money. And that's kind of
is everything. It is. I've enjoyed using M-Pesa very much so.
I'm sure. So I kind of got into that, and that kind of pushed me in the path of looking at technology, but specifically mobile technology and technology in the emerging markets. And so, you know, ended up looking for opportunities, ended up working at a company called Iroko TV out of Nigeria. And Iroko TV was the Netflix of Africa. The third biggest movie market in the world is the Nigerian movie market.
Nollywood,
it comes after Hollywood and Bollywood. It's called Nollywood. And it's huge. And at the time, even now, but at the time, it was nearly impossible to get that content online. And obviously, there's a huge African diaspora that live outside of the continent, in the UK, in Canada, and obviously in the US. And basically, the thesis was going to take the content from Nigeria, put them online, and then the whole world's going to be able to consume it. And I worked at it, you know, we had an office in New York. I worked out in New York, but I was able to travel to Lagos. I was able to travel to London. And I loved it because I was working on a platform where it was like, it was almost like a reverse remittance. Like people are used to like the diaspora sending money back. That's normal and that's interesting. But also there's a cultural remittance that goes the other way where people are getting their movies or their music from where they came from. And so just like you can send money using M-Pesa, you can send content and culture digitally. And so it was a cool, it was cool to play a part of that. And obviously, because at the time it was pretty early, I was exposed to some of the other technologies that are being built on the continent. So like Jumia was built around the same time. Konga was built at the same time. So I was kind of watching that pretty closely. So that was pretty cool. Right. And, you know,
just to inform listeners, Jumia is kind of like a African version of Amazon in a way.
Yes, yes, exactly. Exactly right. And so after I left there, I ended up going to the National Basketball Association. And I worked on, you know, if you're an NBA fan, there's a platform called NBA League Pass, which is just like the African platform I worked on, not because of the content, but it's just streaming content that you can pay a subscription for. And I was on the digital side, so you could watch the games on your phone, on your laptop, you name it. And I worked on the international side of it. So that's kind of why they brought me on. They liked the experience I had working at Iroko TV. And at the time, we actually that's when we launched NBA Africa. And we launched an office in Johannesburg. We actually did a huge deal with, I think it was Econet, one of the big mobile providers on the continent, to help distribute NBA content to the African continent. So I can kind of continue like that, even though I was working at obviously a very American brand out of New York, I was still able to kind of have some part of my work exposed to the continent. Then, like, you know, we mentioned my wife's from Nairobi. So when I go out there, I always kind of try to connect with people and try to understand what's being built out there. And so, you know, last time I was there, it was a pretty cool, the name slips my mind, but it's a shipping company. It's almost like an Uber for shipping that was operating out of Nairobi, which is pretty interesting. So yeah, I always kind of take a look out there. On the Haiti side, no companies, unfortunately, but a lot of initiatives. So like I helped with an initiative a few years ago where there was a gentleman out of that currently works at Slack. He had an initiative where he was teaching some Haitians on the ground how to code Android apps. And so, you know, connect with him and kind of, tried to play a supporting role there. Then there was a woman by the name of Christine Souffrant, and she put together a conference called the Haiti Tech Summit, where she took a lot of individuals from the U.S. to go to Haiti. And, you know, we were at a resort and we just kind of, you know, spoke to Haitian leadership, also had American leadership come in and talk about, increasing the Haitian tech sector. So the president of Haiti spoke. She even had Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Square and Twitter, fly into Haiti to talk about, Haiti and Twitter and tech. She had about Google sent about 35 employees on the ground to do workshops. There was an incubator that was launched. I went over there. I spoke about blockchain and mobile technology, and it was amazing. It was something that it was actually the second time she did it. I definitely encourage people to follow her and check her out. She's doing great work not only in Haiti but elsewhere. Obviously, this year the conference had to be put on pause due to COVID, but hopefully she's going to be able to bring her back. So that's kind of those are the things I've kind of done in Haiti and as well as Africa.
That's pretty amazing, man. Few quick follow-up questions. In Haiti, I already know in Africa that people are very much interested in tech. There are a lot of innovative ideas. At least I could speak from it from the Kenya side of things, having lived there. But in Haiti, did you feel that there was like the pulse was right for kind of this movement towards an interest in tech? I mean, it's great that this initiative, and I remember the conference by Christine Soufflon, a friend of mine, friend of the podcast, sent me the information about it. But how did you feel in terms of about the movement towards it, the interest? Did you think that was something that would stick?
Yeah, so obviously Haiti is much smaller than Kenya and some of these other places. So it's not the same. I think it's Haiti. There is an interest, obviously. Everybody's using mobile phones. Everybody uses WhatsApp. Everybody uses social media. So there is an interest there. And there are people that are trying to build some stuff. I think because the market is much smaller and unfortunately the education base is not as strong, the ambitions of the projects I heard were not as large. That being said, I think Haiti, its proximity to the U.S. could be beneficial. So I guess if you're asking what is Haiti's tech potential tech future, I think the realistic angle is going to be something more of a support, something like where there are outsourced jobs that could be created for American companies instead of going hiring people in Eastern Europe, India, etc. Hire people in Haiti. The language is a slight barrier, so potentially French-speaking tech companies out of like Quebec or France could maybe leverage Haiti as an outpost. That's kind of where I think it. I didn't really hear any like life-breaking projects or anything like that. And Haiti being so small, I don't really see that being realistic. I see it being realistic as like Haiti being a place where you got outsourced developers, outsourced customer service. If you are a direct-to-consumer brand that makes physical goods, you could leverage Haiti as a place to get some of those produced. That's what I see. And I do think there's a lot of ambition that comes from the U.S. that could be ported there. Maybe it's something, and ideally Haiti would be something where you could build like because it's small, you could build something that's regional. But I mean, again, this is probably for another podcast, but Haiti is unfortunately isolated for multiple reasons. It's like the language isolates Haiti. It's culturally probably more aligned with the Hispanic countries that it's between, Cuba and Dominican Republic, but obviously due to racial dynamics, et cetera, it kind of is by its own. So like ideally you would have some kind of, you could build something that could like cover and serve, DR and PR and Barbados and Bahamas and Jamaica, all kind of stuff. And I see something that's probably going to more serve the Latin countries coming out of more one of the Latin countries. I see something that's serving the English Anglophone countries coming out of maybe Trinidad, Jamaica, Barbados, Bermuda, something like that. And then Haiti is kind of left on its own devices.
So we have to figure something out.
But yeah, I think absolutely. This is probably a larger conversation.
For sure. But one thing before we get to our topic of the pod, I'm a fan of changing Haiti's national language from French and Creole to English and Creole, or just add English to the French and Creole
part. 100%. I mean, I think
French serves us no purpose. It serves a purpose for me in terms of, like, you know, someone who's part of the diaspora who, you know, speaking French has helped me get jobs. I'm able to travel and kind of like use that as a key to enter these different communities, but French gives us no comparative advantage. And if you look at Rwanda, Kagame quickly added English as a national language because it just opens opportunities for Rwandans. And I think that it'd be the same thing for Haiti. Or even adding two languages. Why not? I mean, the thing is, Haitians are very, very crafty and resilient. If you go to Haiti, you'll find someone who speaks English, French, Spanish, and Creole. And it's just, to me, it's almost pointless at this point to have French as our national language. It serves, you know, internally, it serves a purpose to separate and divide Haitians. But other than that, I don't see what other purpose it serves. But I'm
totally on board. I actually think it's one of those, like, it sounds very small, but it's going to be very big. You can have it's going to be very big and hard to implement, but also it could have outsized gains. And you're right. Like, you know, I work in technology. Like, we consistently hire people from English speaking countries to, you know, do customer service and all kind of stuff. And obviously these are not huge jobs, but like, that's a family in Philippines that's being fed. And then it just spreads and spreads. And so Haiti. Yeah. I'm totally for it. I think we should start a movement. Maybe put some t-shirts out, like make English great again in Haiti.
I don't know.
That's gonna be a battle, but it's a very concise movement that should be put in place. I think we spoke a lot about my background in Haiti, all that kind of stuff. Like you said, I think we want to talk about some other topics that
So one of the things that made me reach out to you to have you on the podcast, you posted a couple of really good articles. So in light of what's going on, what has been going on in the U.S. for hundreds of years, but now it's under a microscope for 2020. It has been the police brutality in various U.S. cities throughout the country, really. But there have been certain cities that have been really focused on. It started off with the wrongful and brutal murder of George Floyd that we all saw, whether it's on YouTube or Instagram. I remember waking up in bed and watching this man get suffocated by the police. But you posted some interesting articles that focused on the financial repercussions of police brutality on citizens, on taxpayers, and potential examples. I mean, I'll read off the articles. The first one was, I believe, a Vice article on how cities offload the costs of police brutality. And then one that kind of mentioned some interesting suggestions to solutions. And I believe it was a Quartz article to stop police brutality, make it financially unsustainable. So I guess if you could give a short background on these articles, and then the first question I'd like to ask you is, can you explain a bit about how taxpayers are responsible for police legal fees and the costs associated with the end results of police brutality? For example, the lawyers for the police, maybe money that goes to families who have lost someone at the hands of police. We see sometimes at the end of these heinous crimes, families are rewarded, which says something that if families are rewarded upwards of, you know, millions of dollars, that there was definitely wrongful acts. But can you talk a little bit about how it affects taxpayers?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Great question. Yeah, I mean, obviously we're in this weird time in this country, but, you know, hopefully it's going to bring about some change. But in my eyes, I think a lot of, I mean, high level, before I get into answer your questions, I think high level that we need to, I think a lot of the narrative has been pushed in a way that is dependent on people's empathy, specifically white people's empathy. And I think there are white people that are empathetic and sure. care, but I don't think that could last, because just people just are self-serving by nature. B, I don't think that's something that's going to push policy changes. I think the narrative needs to go towards what people are incentivized, and, you know, for better or for worse, people are incentivized by their pockets. And money, you know, money in economics, you could look at it as just like whatever, greed or whatever. It's really more incentives, right? Economics is really around incentives, right? Money goes towards where people are incentivized and motivated to. And so I think it's very important to kind of focus on the dollars that are that play a part in this. And you're right, because, and it sounds crass because people's lives are at stake, but guess what? People are getting paid. Families are getting paid for these losses. So there's obviously money being put. So we should kind of dig into that. And so for me, being somebody, obviously, you know, I studied finance in undergrad and grad. I worked in Wall Street. My mind definitely goes to like financing, funding, etc. And so, yeah, that's kind of what pushed me on this thread. So I actually heard about this through an awesome podcast called EYL, Earn Your Leisure. They had an episode around this, and it kind of just
they are dope.
So I definitely put me on that. Yeah. So they did some content around it, and so that kind of sparked my interest. So I have to give props to them. But I just dug even deeper, and so yeah. So what happens is, you know, cops are extensions of cities because they are city employees. Taxpayers pay cop salary, right? You know, we pay taxes. The city has a budget. You know, the city makes money from a lot of different things, but the majority of it comes from taxpayers. And especially for people that live in New York City, they pay an additional 4% city tax just to kind of, you know, have the right to be in those five boroughs. So that goes to, you know, a portion that goes to paying NYPD. And it's not only NYPD salary, but it's NYPD insurance. It's, you know, 401k matching, it's retirement, it's overtime. But also it's the fines that come out when the police misbehave. And unfortunately, this happens quite a bit. And the reason why would the city pay and not the individuals? Well, first off, there's a lot of reasons for that. But the simple answer is that when people sue, they always look at who has the biggest pockets. So like if you trip at an office building and you break your ankle because there's a puddle of water, yeah, hypothetically you could try to sue the janitor, but that doesn't happen. You're gonna sue the building, the landlord, right? And that's the same kind of thing that happens with cities. People sue the big, larger pockets. They sue the entity that allowed the police officer to be positioned to misbehave, and that entity is the wider police department, which is a sub entity of the city. Therefore, taxpaying dollars goes to paying for these lives that are lost. So a lot of times people hear, oh, like whatever, Mike, you know, Michael Brown's family or Trayvon family, they settled civil suit and they got X amount of $1 million. And it kind of just kind of goes into the abyss. That's
almost
your
like,
money.
Almost like they benefited off of the debt.
Yeah. I'm going to even put it another way. Even if you think they benefited, and you, let's say you're a racist, you don't care about these lives, black lives don't matter to you, but guess what? You, that's still your money that going into Trayvon Martin's family's pockets, right? So, or I mean, Trayvon's is, that was a civilian, so let's, that's a bad example. That's not a great example, but let's just say whatever George Floyd's family ends up getting, that is your, that's your hard-earned dollars. So even if you do not care about these people's lives and you are about Blue Lives Matter, you have to admit that if they don't change their practices, your pockets are getting hit no matter what. Just because, like, these, you know, you, these cases end up with financial repercussions, and it's right. taxpayers that pay it. So, you know, it is the right thing to do to, you know, adjust policing in a way that protects lives. But even if you think police are perfect, you have to admit they're not, because your money is being used to augment their misbehavior. So that's kind of how, yeah, that, I mean, I feel like this is an argument that should hit everybody. And it's pretty plain. Like, policing needs to change because we're losing money because of it.
Right. So the article you shared on your social media, it focused on Minneapolis because that's where the civil unrest started for 2020 in terms of police brutality. But what other city comes to mind?
Yeah, so it's quite a few different cities. Obviously, you know, our home city of New York City comes about, and we grew up with a lot of cases, you know, with your queen, Sean Bell.
Sean, that's my first protest, man. Sean Bell. This is my
first so protest we're Haitian American. So you have Patrick Dorisman. Abner Louima was not killed, but he was assaulted. So we grew up with this, and so obviously that my mind goes to NYPD first, and NYPD has put out a lot of money in the settlements. And a lot of, and one thing that people don't understand is, like, not all of this stuff ends up on TV. Like, there are so many cases that are like a million here, half a million there, 10 million here, right. And it adds up. And the crazy number that happens is that I looked at the NYPD budget, well, the New York City budgetary site, which talks about where all the money's going. And they mentioned that the tort claim, the NYPD tort claim settlement payouts went down 7%, and they kind of put it as a bullet, as if it was a great thing. But then you look at the numbers, you're like, what? Are you still celebrating? So the 7% was from a number of $237 million in 2018 to $220 million in 2019. That's a lot of money. Like, that's that's 237,000,000, right? Like, it's like a quarter of a sports team. It's a new stadium, right? It's that Jet Stadium that they blocked on the west side that they didn't build.
It's books in schools.
Books in schools. I mean, for the folks that are, you know, in Williamsburg, that were crying about the L train going down, like, that's money that could have made sure the L train never had issues, right? So, and obviously, again, you know, schools, books in schools, college prep, you know, resources to all type of resources for the community to help uplift, and this is just basically money that's gone to the abyss, that's wasted, just because you know, individuals don't know how to police correctly, and that needs to be stopped. Like, nobody wants wasted money, and I don't think people really understand it, because it gets hidden in, like, these legalese and deep documents, but actually, like, it's real and direct. And, you know, New York is not the only place. Chicago, should we talk about what happens when the tax base is not large enough
for people? Exactly. That's what I wanted to ask. How do these cities that are already stretched in on their budgets how are they paying these types of settlements?
Yeah, so what happens is New York City obviously is a city that has a lot of residents, has a lot of income for multiple facets, but not all cities in New York. Other cities that even are people compared to New York don't even have the same kind of income base. So Chicago is an example, right? So Chicago obviously is considered a second city. It's a top five city in the country. They also have a policing problem, and they did not have enough funds in order to pay off the judgments, and so they had to come out and in 2017 they took out $225 million in bonds to pay off police settlement debts. And so what are these bonds? First off, yes, these bonds are basically a loan that bonds are just basically loans that people issue. And all type of entities introduce bonds. But when cities and states introduce bonds, they're called municipal bonds. And bonds are very normal. So sometimes bonds are used to build a bridge, build a highway, build all type of things. And obviously, like every kind of loan, these loans are you pay interest on it. So it's almost like a credit card. And so not only is it like the $225 million, but people that have had mortgages, have had credit cards, know that the amount that you end up paying when you add in interest and compounding ends up being a lot larger than that. So it could end up being double that for the Chicago taxpayers. And again, it's all because of police training, police over aggression, etc. And the name for these bonds, these municipal bonds that are issued because of police debt, people call them police brutality bonds. Obviously, those are not.
They have a name. That's not the official name, but everyone knows.
Yeah, that's how everybody knows it as, because it's
same way as like how people know undershirts as wife beaters, even though that's not the right
exactly,
name.
Exactly. And like it's actually a huge thing. There've been many cities that have issued police brutality bonds. So and what happens is when you have bonds, going back to finance, there are a lot of people that actually play a part in that. So you have companies like a Goldman Sachs, a Morgan Stanley that help package these bonds, because you need an entity that. It's like, hey, you guys, you need $225 million. Let's issue a bond, but people have to buy that bond. So therefore, you have to market that bond, right? You have to create fancy marketing documents around these bonds. You have to go in and go to mutual funds and etc. to sell them. Like, hey, this is a bond that you should include in your client's portfolio, and for that, these individuals get they get fees for that. Right, so you have people that are actually profiting from the issuances of these bonds, which is terrible, right? Terrible.
So, what would you say what solutions would you propose to changing this? I know you kind of touched on it a bit about letting people understand how it's hitting their pockets, but in terms of what you read about or what you feel, what solutions would you propose?
Yeah, so one thing is, I think you got to start hitting the cops in their pockets as well. I think obviously the police person does not have money to pay millions of dollars because their salaries are whatever their salaries are, but they have the average middle income salary in whatever geography they work out of, so that doesn't make sense. But I actually think that maybe the settlement should come out of police pensions. That could be an impact. So if a percentage of, because a big attraction to policing is the pension that you get. You get a certain percentage of your salary for life almost. And so that is attractive. So if you start hitting that could be interesting. I think you should push police officers themselves to take insurance. So almost like doctors take malpractice insurance because they could be sued for making mistakes and doing things wrong and costing lives. You could do the same thing for policemen. And the way the insurance works is insurance is priced on risk. And so if a police officer is part of a department that has historically been high risk for payouts because their style of policing is over aggressive, they're going to pay high premiums. What do you think is going to happen? They're going to push their comrades, the leadership, the training to adjust the policing style because their insurance is more expensive, right? It's almost like, you know, if you share a car with your spouse and your spouse gets caught for drunk driving and accidents all the time, but like now as a family, you have to pay Geico a lot more. You're going to push your spouse to stop drinking and driving or stop driving in general, right?
A bomb, exactly.
Right. So I think those are some interesting things that could, play a part. And if on the insurance vein, some people have had so many accidents or what have you that they can't even get car insurance. So you may have something where if a municipality has so many cases, insurance company may just say, we're not going to cover you, or we're only going to cover you if you do X, Y, and Z. And X, Y, and Z would be training and policy changes that are going to decrease the chances that, there'll be a judgment put against them and then the insurance company will have to pay. So I think there's some systematic guardrails that could be put in place. If you spread some of the costs around these payments into and it starts to hit the police officers in indirect ways, but direct enough to incentivize them to change.
Right. One last question for you before I, because the time give you a chance to plug everything you're working on. Are there solutions that are being talked about like this? Are they being considered, or is this kind of all now kind of, this is what the ideal situation would be? It's a pipe dream at this point.
Yeah, there's some things that are happening in some small cities. Like in one of the articles, one of the researchers, and again, it's very small places. This is in Idaho. Basically, like there was a case of an insurance risk manager in Idaho who incurred liability issues in a local county jail. And basically to address it, he created a list of changes that the jail needed to make, like having a nurse or having the medical personnel available, and then also extend the insurance to a statewide pool, right? So basically, like, not only that county and its jail would be covered, they would have the whole state of Idaho would be part of one pool. Therefore, like the good actors or the good jails, if you will, would have to be exposed to the bad jail's behavior. And so what happens is like and it changed. It changes. So what happens is a lot of the counties, because they were all in it together, basically all the counties that needed their jails covered by their insurance made the changes that were suggested. So that's a pretty, and obviously Idaho doesn't have the same population as some of these places that we talk about, but that's one example of how this insurance and the premiums and the risk manager was able to push change inside of one geography.
Right. Well, it's usually going to start with smaller places, as we see. We'll see how the reparations work out in Asheville, North Carolina. Asheville, yep. Ashford, saying it right. And we'll see the result of that. Fritz, this was amazing, man. We need to do this again because there's so many things that we can discuss. But can you please plug the listeners on anything that you're working on that they could be on the lookout for?
Sure. No, thank you, man. This is a pleasure and honor. Like I said, we there were so many different tangents that we had to catch ourselves on because we could have made another hour podcast. Like we could have a four hour long podcast talking about a lot of things we talk about.
Like roots.
Yeah.
Seven exactly. Podcasts.
So, we definitely have to do it again. Thank you for having me. People want to reach out to me. My name is my name is Fritz Charles. So you can find me on LinkedIn, but my social media name is Fritz Chain. It's kind of play on my name and blockchain in one. So Fritz Chain on IG, Fritz Chain on Twitter. I spend time, tweeting about blockchain, as well as other technology, specifically mobile applications. So I, you know, also have a podcast where I talk about, you know, finance and technology called Coin Gamma. We focus on, you know, educating people around the crypto sector. You can also find Coin Gamma. You can find Coin Gamma, your whatever podcast solution that you use. Twitter is Coin Gamma. IG is Coin Gamma. It's coingamma.com. And, you know, if somebody wants to email me, it's my first name, fritz@coingamma.com. Happy to connect with people. And you know, anybody that's working on this this issue, I'd love to, you know, play a supporting role in kind of elevating people's work in this. But, you know, thank you. Thank you for having me, Joel.
Thank you for being on, man. And we'll do this again. Peace out to everybody. Everybody stay safe. Thanks again, Fritz.
Thank you.